Ekatra Podcast Conversations. For the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome, everyone. So today we're doing a deep dive into a really foundational text.
Yeah, one that totally changed the game for how we look at Islamic art.
Exactly. Irene A. Bierman's landmark work, Islamic Art, Context, Function, and Epigraphy.
And look, this isn't just some dusty book for art historians, right?
No, not at all. What we want to do today is give you, well, a kind of shortcut.
Mm-hmm. A way to get past those.
Yeah.
You know, the standard kind of flat ideas about what Islamic art even means, the stereotypes.
Right. Because Bierman presents this truly transformative argument. She basically forces us to stop asking, okay, what does it look like?
Yeah, that surface level question.
And instead ask something much deeper. What was this art intended to do? What was its actual job in its society?
And getting that function piece, that's the key, really, to a deeper cultural understanding. It moves beyond just aesthetics.
So to get into that, we should probably talk about the author first, Irene Bierman.
Absolutely. Irene A. Bierman, she taught at UCLA, a really distinguished American art historian.
Mm-hmm.
But her specialty wasn't just, you know, paintings on a wall. She focused on this intersection of art, architecture, language, and power. That combination is crucial.
And her real authority, it seems, comes from digging deep into epigraphy.
That's it. Epigraphy, which is basically the study of writing in visual culture. Think inscriptions on buildings, coins, textiles, everything.
So she wasn't just listing where the writing was.
No, no. She brought in ideas from semiotics, the study of signs and symbols, to actually decode the communication happening through the art and the writing. Like, what message was being sent?
Which forces this huge shift in perspective,
yeah.
Right? Because most art books,
yeah.
They walk you through styles, periods, dynasties.
Right, the chronological slog sometimes. But Bierman flips it. She asks about function. What was this thing doing for the people who made it, who paid for it?
Who was the audience? What was the intended message?
Exactly. It's about seeing art as an active player, socially, politically, not just a pretty object.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what gives her work such impact.
Okay, so let's unpack the main idea, the core thesis of the book.
Well, fundamentally, she wants to dismantle this notion of a single monolithic Islamic art that's purely defined by religion.
Right. As if it's all the same everywhere, unchanging.
Yeah. And she says, no, wait, what we call Islamic art is actually this incredibly diverse, dynamic mix of traditions.
And the meaning isn't inherent in the style alone.
Precisely. The meaning gets shaped actively by the local context, the social situation, the political needs, the specific culture it's in.
So how does she organize all this diversity, if not by time period?
Ah, that's the clever part. Instead of dynasty by dynasty, she uses a thematic approach based on function, or maybe arena is a better word.
Arena.
Yeah, she divides the art world into four key arenas of life. There's the sacred space, think the mosque, then the exclusive world of the palace, then the public sphere, you know, the city itself. And finally, the intimate realm, portable stuff, personal objects.
That framework immediately makes sense. It forces you to think about where the art lived and who saw it.
Exactly. Context becomes everything. And her core insight, the thing she hammers home, is that you have to learn to, like, read the art.
And reading means paying attention to the writing, the epigraphy.
Paying intense attention to it. Because often this public writing isn't just decoration. It's the main event. It's political. It's powerful. It's conceptual. It is the message.
Which brings us to what you said is maybe her most revolutionary point. The absolute primacy of writing.
Yes, this is huge. Bierman argues that writing in public spaces on those grand buildings, sure, but also on coins, on fancy textiles, it wasn't just added on later for looks.
It wasn't ornamental trim.
Not at all. It was performative. It was doing something. It was an act, a religious act, a political statement, a claim of power made solid and visible for everyone to see.
Okay, give us an example. The Dome of the Rock seems key here.
Definitely. The Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, built way back by the Umayyad Caliph Abd al-Malik. Inside, you have these massive, stunning Quranic inscriptions in gold mosaic.
Just beautiful. But Bierman says the specific verses chosen weren't random, right?
Far from it. Think about the location, Jerusalem. A hugely contested city, sacred to Jews and Christians too. The dome is built near the Holy Sepulchre and the Old Temple site.
A statement in itself.
A massive physical statement. But Bierman shows the text itself was chosen very specifically to speak to the large Christian population there.
How so?
The inscriptions strongly assert Islam's strict monotheism, one God, and they clarify the status of Jesus as a prophet, but a human prophet challenging core Christian beliefs about his divinity.
Wow. So the building itself, through its text, is engaging in a public theological debate.
Precisely. A permanent, unavoidable dialogue carved in gold. The writing is the monument's voice, its argument.
That idea of writing as active declaration versus passive declaration, that's a game changer. But the message depends on where you are, right? Bierman gets into that nuance.
Oh, absolutely. The contrast between the mosque and the palace, the sacred and the secular, is a perfect illustration.
Let's take the sacred first, like the Great Mosque of Cordoba.
Okay, Cordoba. Famously an iconic, no figures of people or animals, why? To focus the mind on God's abstract, transcendent nature, away from idols.
And the architecture itself has a job to do.
Totally. That amazing hypostyle hall, you know, that forest of columns stretching out, it creates this feeling of infinite, undifferentiated space.
Reflecting.
Reflecting the equality of all believers before God. The architecture embodies a theological concept.
Okay, so that's the mosque. Now, shift gears to the secular space, say, the Alhambra Palace, also in Spain, not far away.
Right. The Alhambra in Granada function, totally different. This art is about projecting the ruler's power, their wealth, their sophistication, but to a very select courtly audience.
And the rules change inside the palace walls.
Big time. Suddenly you do see figural imagery, the famous Court of the Lions, for instance, and crucially, look at the inscriptions.
Not Quranic verses.
No. While the mosque walls preach the Quran, the Alhambra's walls are covered in incredibly intricate stucco work featuring secular poetry.
Really? What kind of poetry?
Lyrical verses praising the beauty of the palace itself, the gardens, the ruler's glory. It's personal, political, aesthetic, a world away from the mosque's public sermon.
That contrast just blows open the idea of a single Islamic art, doesn't it?
It really does. And Bierman doesn't stop there. She zooms out to the whole city, the urban environment as a stage.
How art shapes the city itself.
Think of the Registan Square in Samarkand. Those enormous madrasas, clad in dazzling blue tile work, the sheer scale and symmetry.
Breathtaking, even in photos.
It was designed to be breathtaking. Its urban planning is political theater. It shouts imperial power, the Timurid Empire's might across the city square, meant to awe visitors and subjects alike. The city becomes a canvas for power.
Okay, and while we're talking function and context, we need to address that common misconception about figures, about images of people and animals.
Yes, that's important. Bierman is really clear. The avoidance of figures, that aniconism we mentioned, it was primarily for the sacred context of the mosque to avoid any hint of idolatry.
It wasn't a blanket ban everywhere?
Definitely not. It thrived in secular arts. The prohibition was functional, tied to the purpose of the space.
Like in illustrated books.
Exactly. Look at Persian miniature painting. Manuscripts of epics like the Shahnameh, the Persian national epic, they are filled with vibrant scenes of kings, heroes, battles, mythical creatures.
So totally fine in that context.
Totally fine. Because the function was different storytelling, courtly entertainment, historical record, not religious worship. The rules followed the function.
Okay, this is incredibly clarifying. Let's try to boil down Bierman's analysis into maybe three core themes that you, the listener, can really take away.
Sounds good. Theme number one, and we've hit this hard, but it's crucial, the primacy of writing.
Calligraphy is the star player.
Absolutely. It's not just making things look nice. It's making the divine word visible. It's proclaiming who's in charge. It's even thought to bestow a kind of protective power or blessing baraka.
Can you explain baraka just a bit more?
Sure. Baraka is like a spiritual energy, a sacred blessing, maybe a protective quality. The idea is that the writing itself, especially scripture, infuses the object or building with this positive sacred force.
So the writing is functional in a spiritual sense too, almost like visible magic.
You could sort of think of it that way, yes. Yeah. It's doing spiritual work.
Got it. Okay, theme number two.
This one really reframes how you look at any art, I think. Context determines meaning.
The meaning isn't just locked inside the object.
Exactly. Bierman insists it's not fixed. Take a Quranic verse. Its impact, its function is totally different if it's booming across a huge mosque facade versus being tiny, carved on a personal amulet you wear.
The audience matters. The material, the size, the location.
All of it. They are what interpret the art, what give it its specific meaning in that moment, in that place.
Okay. And the third big theme.
Deconstructing the monolith. Basically, her main takeaway message is, stop thinking of Islamic art as one single thing.
Reject the generic label.
Yes. Embrace the diversity. She emphasizes how much it was shaped by local traditions that existed before Islam Byzantine styles in Syria and Egypt, Sasanian traditions in Persia and Iraq.
Plus, different languages, different political needs across this vast area.
Right. It's a constellation of related but distinct traditions, not a uniform blob.
Those themes are powerful. And Bierman has some really memorable ways of putting these ideas. We sort of paraphrased a few key concepts to capture the essence.
Yeah, like distilling her core arguments.
Okay, here's the first one about that unity and diversity idea. The notion that Islamic art is not a monolith, but a constellation of related traditions that share certain aesthetic and spiritual principles while expressing the full diversity of Islamic civilization.
That captures it well. Shared principles, but diverse expression. What's next?
This one nails her point about epigraphy, the concept that public writing was not an ornament applied to architecture. It was a primary reason for the architecture's existence.
Boom! The writing wasn't decoration, it justified the building. It gave it its purpose.
And finally, what about those famous geometric patterns, which can seem just complexly decorative?
Yes, the
The
geometry.
idea that every geometric pattern contains within it the possibility of infinite extension, reflecting the Islamic understanding of divine infinity.
That's such a beautiful insight. It elevates geometry beyond just math or pattern making. You're visualizing the infinite, the eternal, the divine order.
It gives the abstract design a profound spiritual dimension.
Absolutely. It connects the visual form directly to a core philosophical and religious concept.
So, thinking about all this, how can we, apply this functional way of looking at things to our own world today? Does it have real-life applications?
I think it absolutely does. For starters, it builds critical visual literacy. Once you learn to read the cues in historical Islamic art, like where is the inscription placed? Why that motif? What's the scale telling us?
You start noticing similar things elsewhere.
Exactly. You can apply that same questioning to modern cityscapes, to public monuments, even to corporate branding. What message is this building, this logo, this ad trying to send? Who is it for? What power dynamics are at play?
It makes you a more active observer, less passive.
Definitely. And related to that is understanding power and patronage. Bierman shows so clearly how rulers used art and architecture to legitimize their rule, to project ideology.
And we see that today too, right?
All the time. Think
Yeah.
about the design of government buildings, courthouse pillars, bank headquarters trying to look solid and timeless, or even how politicians use backdrops and symbols.
They're using visual language to communicate power, stability, specific ideas.
Precisely. Bierman's framework helps you decode that. It makes you more aware of how the visual world is constantly trying to shape our perceptions, often politically.
Okay, wrapping up this deep dive. For me, the biggest takeaway, the thing that really sticks, is that paradigm shift from focusing purely on form, what does it look like, to focusing on function.
What did it do?
What work was this object, this building, performing in its society? What was its job, its purpose, its audience? Asking those questions first, that changes everything.
I agree, that's huge. And for me, linked to that, it's the profound, multifaceted role of the written word. After reading Bierman, you just can't see an inscription as mere decoration ever again. It's a voice, it's a sermon, it's a political speech, it's a poem made permanent and public in the visual landscape. It's an act. That understanding is incredibly powerful.
A truly fascinating shift in perspective from Irene Bierman. A phenomenal place to end our conversation today. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.